It's the UEFA Champions League on Paramount Plus. Europe's top club soccer tournament. Champions versus champions. The best teams facing off in the knockout rounds.
Magnificent!
And it all takes place
while you're filling out financial reports at work. In the middle of your day, in the middle of your week. So use that second screen. Call in sick. Do whatever you gotta do to tune in Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Nobody watches the UEFA Champions League like us. Stream every match live exclusively on Paramount Plus.
Welcome to the 24/7 Sports College Basketball Show. I'm your host, Tani Levitt, joined, as always, by college basketball's assist king, Jerry Meyer. Jerry, welcome to 2020.
Yeah, new year. Good to be here with you.
We did it. We're here.
Yeah.
And now we've got some basketball to talk about. We're going to talk about the evolution of the modern game today. Really excited because it's not every basketball show that has someone with the institutional knowledge that Jerry does to be able to teach us the ins and outs of the game. So really excited about that. But first, I need to find out. Jerry has been away from the show for a week. And so we're going to catch up on last week's show. But first, I need to know, Jerry, how did you spend your holidays?
With family. I have both my children here with me and spend some time with my sisters and my mom, you know, pretty much the usual what everyone does.
Wholesome man, Jerry Meyer. Love that. Love that. Well, last week without you, I broke down my personal list of the five craziest things that that happened in college basketball in 2020. And so before we get into the main event of today's show, a little basketball education with Jerry, I wanted to run down that list real quick for you and see if you...
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, see if you have anything that I missed there, if anything that you think I overrated. So starting off, let's see if I can remember the order. I know the five. I'm not sure I remember the order, so I'm going to try to do it in order. So number five, I had Zion's shoe. Zion's shoe blowing. Actually, I think this was higher. Not important. So I had Zion's shoe because I just thought, like, seeing someone that size, that magnitude, that moment exploding out of his shoe in the moment was crazy. Then it led to his injury. Then that led to the whole conversation about whether or not he should stay. And then he came back. And then he got a crazy shoe deal, like a super lots of money shoe deal, which is awesome. And I just felt like all this circus surrounding Zion's shoe had to make the list for me.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. That was one of the weirdest things I've ever seen. I've never seen a shoe completely explode. I mean, I've seen guys, I mean, I've had it happen to me. You pop a seam in your shoe, you know, you make a cut, it, you know, breaks apart, but that thing exploded.
I know. And you think, like, nowadays, the shoes are made much nicer than they were, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And two, like, people play so many games. Like, Zion was playing, you know, it was his freshman year. So he had just finished his AAU circuit. And it's like, when you play that many games, you would have thought that Zion was changing his shoes fairly frequently, but he wasn't. That was, like, part of the problem.
Oh, is that the word? He was using some worn-out shoes?
Well, he liked those shoes, and he wore them.
That's how I did it. Watching the game today, you're talking about the evolution of the game. I mean, these guys, like, wear a new pair of shoe every game.
Yeah, that's
like in the NBA guys. Like, yeah. I couldn't have done that. Surely they're breaking them in, getting them ready.
But maybe they wear them for a practice or two before they wear them.
There's got to be something like that going on. I have not researched that. But, yeah, once I got comfortable in a pair of basketball shoes, I was going to wear them to the end.
I was thinking about this. I was talking to my dad. He was visiting for the holidays, and he was asking me, like, because I told him I joined a rec league, and he was like, do you need new basketball shoes? I said, no, I like my basketball shoes. And I was thinking about it. I've, like, had these for 3 years. should probably get new ones if I wanted to
How's your game? Have you played yet?
Games haven't started yet. Right. I'm hoping
to. You training?
I'm definitely hitting the gym. You can't say I've been on a court since the summer. I'm hoping to make some smart passes, you know, get involved in the boards, play fundamental defense, and if some corner threes appear, then, you know, I'll do what I have to do. But
get ready for those threes.
That's right.
Get some reps. You need to get in the gym. Get some shots up.
If I know anything about rec league, is that everyone thinks that they're going to be shooting corner threes, and like inevitably I'm going to end up playing point guard, and that's just going to be a disaster for everybody. So they'd be like, "Oh yeah, you played in high school." I was like, "Yeah, at a tiny school in a terrible conference." But we digress. So number five for me, or one of the five, was Zion Chu. I think below Zion Chu, I had just the general phenomenon of Ja Morant. I mean, this dude in 2018 was like the third best player on his team, and then all of a sudden he's like the number two player in the draft, and he just spent all of 2019 yamming on dudes, like trying to kill them, and then he continued doing that in the NBA, and I just thought that like that was crazy, that rapid ascent and evolution.
Yeah, phenomenal talent. I love watching him play. I loved watching him, you know, last year at Murray State, because of course you get the athleticism and the dunking. I just love what he can do with his left hand. His passing with one hand, you talk about an evolved game, kind of breaking all the rules of, you know, olden day fundamentals, but pulls it off, you know, with great skill. And then his vision and his passing, I think he has a special sense of the court.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's something special. As much as we like to talk about analytics and we're going to talk about efficiency and what makes the most sense in modern basketball in the back half of the show, but there's something special about that playground, just like, I'm going to take you one-on-one, take you to the rack. Like, as much as we talk about, you know, making smart passes and taking corner threes because they're efficient, just being able to break someone down one-on-one like he does and attack the rim like he does, it's visceral. And that's kind of like when I thought, like when I was little, about like what was like really good about basketball, just like that mano a mano that he has. And he's really, you know, I don't think he's stupid about it, but I just think it's amazing. You know, when you see him going up among the trees and just trying to dunk, you know, it's crazy.
I like that visceral. And the guys that are really special, they do, you get a visceral response or experience when you watch him. He's definitely one of those guys. But he's also that guy who has that one-on-one game.
Exactly.
But he sees the court. He's a guy that makes everything easier for his teammates because he can create a four-on-three. He can create a three-on-two. Your man's going to have to help on him, or your man's going to have to rotate to the guy whose man helped on him. So he would be a very, very fun player to play with.
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to talk in the back half about how important it is to get, you know, opposing defenses in rotation. That's already, when they're moving, there's more, plenty of opportunities for you to attack that defense. So I had Ja Morant in there. At number three, I had Virginia's buzzer beater to tie the game against Purdue. And that was just kind of my entry point to talk about Virginia's insane year, because obviously the year before, the first one to lose to a 16, and then to go and win the national title just a year later. And they had like a million close games. I know you can only play six games in the NCAA tournament, but it felt like they played 20, you know, down to the wire games. And the buzzer beater against Purdue, that I will never forget that. That pass from Kihei Clark, three quarters of the court with 2 seconds left. Who thinks that? Like, who thinks I'm going to pass here? Like, all I could think of when I, every time I rewatched the highlight and when I was watching it live, all I could think of was shoot. There's 2 seconds left. You're down. Mm-hmm. You got to shoot. And he passed that ball. It was crazy.
Yep. Virginia winning close games, three great guards. I'm going to call DeAndre Hunter a guard. That he's basically playing the two in the NBA. But you got a guy, you know, Guy and Jerome, you're going to win ball games. They had a great team, but it really wasn't – I don't think – were people expecting Virginia to win it? You know, I wasn't, especially what happened in the past year. And it showed a certain style. You know, Tony Bennett's gotten some criticism. You know, his style of play, he's not going to do it in March. So it was very interesting to watch. Very happy for him, and it's nice to see something different. And I thought those three perimeter players were fantastic throughout the tournament.
Yeah, and you know, we were talking off mic about disingenuous criticisms in basketball right before we started, and I always thought that the criticism of Tony Bennett's defensive system was disingenuous. When you talk about, like, well, they won last year, well, what did that team have in addition to Tony Bennett's defensive style? Three pros, right? When you have pros, you're going to do things. And
well, that's kind of the point.
Yeah, right? Like, if you're playing run and gun.
He had pros. All right, so you can play a lot of different styles. It's a belief in the style, and it's an execution of the style. And that team did it. You know, and I think more of the criticism of Tony's been the offense. When I've been critical, you know, I thought a couple of years, you know, they're running that blocker cutter offense, which his dad created. You know, basically two guys are screeners, and then you have two running off screens, and then a hybrid. The fifth guy's like a hybrid guy. I thought they went through a period last, like maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago, where they didn't really run it with precision. And there wasn't a real, you know, meticulous effort to get that perfect screen, to rub off that screen just right. Like they're just kind of running around. And that's what we see with a lot of college teams today. It's like, yeah, you're on offense. I guess you're running an offense, but are you really running an offense? And this Virginia team, I thought they really ran some offense in that championship run.
Yeah, I think a lot of college basketball fans, I should say, don't quite understand that most college teams don't actually run plays. They run motions and sets.
Or, yeah, and a big word right now is action.
Exactly. You know. And whatever you want to call it, sometimes I feel like college basketball teams are going through the motions, not
running
the motion.
Totally agree. It's one of my pet peeves. It's when I want to change the channel because I have little tolerance. I want to see a sense of purpose.
Yes.
Almost the entire time. What is the point of running 15 seconds of nothing? You know, I don't get it. I don't want to watch that. You know, let's get to it. Let's get the action, you know. That's why I like the 24-second clock. Let's get it going, man. Get in your action. If it's going to take you, you know, I want to see action right away.
I completely agree. And we can move on after this. But one of the things that drives me nuts is when a point guard will be pressured full court, but it's just one-on-one. And he'll insist on the point guard will make basically the big who inbounded the ball set screens like three times before he crosses half court, just crossing over. You're initiating your offense at 22 seconds. You just wasted like an eighth of the clock. That's right. Stupid.
Well, you might do that if you want to mess with that defender.
I guess.
Because, yes. I used to play point guard. And it's not fun when you try to pressure full court if you have a big guy you're trying to avoid and, you know, you got physical contact involved. That might be a reason why sometimes that takes place to basically try to beat down that defender to open things
all
up.
Right,
I'm being picky here.
That's why we have you.
I agree with what you're saying. I didn't like that when I played. I think if a point guard's any good, well, let's put it this way. If a point guard can't bring the ball up the court one-on-one against pressure, he should not be a college point guard, you know. So I agree. I think there's a lot of overkill with that. I'm the type of guy, get to the point guard, they want to pressure, beat that guy, and let's play 5-on-4, and let's look for a shot right now. I don't understand, you know, like you hear it from announcers, pass up the wing. Guy takes a three in transition. Of course, if he makes it, it's a good shot. But if he happens to miss, oh, that was a quick shot. I don't think that's what they wanted. You need to run some. Why do you need to run offense? I mean, you got an open shot in transition with your body moving towards your target. A shot you work on in practice. This is not the 1970s, you know, or in the 1950s. This is 2020. You take that shot. You know, and if you're up and if you've got 5-on-4, why you want to set it up? Let's set it up. So now we let the defense get set. We have to play 5-on-5. Yeah, I do not like that type of basketball. You look for the advantage and you attack. If you have to run action, you have good, crisp, precise action that makes sense for your personnel. And let's play basketball.
I completely
quit wasting
agree.
Time out there.
And to bring this full circle, one of the craziest things about Kihei Clark's pass against Purdue was that somehow from he and Kyle Guy ran after that rebound. So in essence, Purdue was playing 5-on-3 defense around the basket, and still Clark made such a good pass that it was a 1-on-1 when Mamadi Diakite was shooting that floater. So that was my number three.
Well, and it was unexpected too.
Exactly,
and that's the beauty of the play, as you laid out earlier. That's the type of basketball I like, yeah.
So that was number three. Number two I had was from this season, pretty much the only thing that happened during this actual basketball season was Stephen F. Austin over Duke. When you talk about how good Duke has been at home in the non-conference over the past two decades, when you talk about the gulf in talent, when you talk about the fact that it happened in overtime, the fact that there was a buzzer beater, the way it was a buzzer beater, the steal, the run out, the close, and then after the fact, when you find out that Bane, the player who hit the buzzer beater, his family obviously had experienced devastation in their community, and he had the GoFundMe, and it raised some crazy amount of money. That whole story was just too much to leave off, and so for me, that was my number two.
Yeah, great story, and you know, great for Stephen F. Austin and their program and all their individuals. Kyle Keller's been coaching a long time. You could really tell it meant a lot to him. And I think it served as a wake-up call for Duke. It seems like they've been a lot better since then. And I would throw, I agree with you. I think the Duke loss is of a more magnitude, but Evansville beating Kentucky in Kentucky, Lexington, that was pretty big too. Just to throw out another one. But yeah, I would go with Duke.
I almost included that simply because.
And plus, Evansville is close to Lexington. You know, you got a little.
Well, I was just going to say because both Stephen F. Austin and Evanston wear purple.
That's a power color.
That's right. You know,
the color of royalty.
That's right. And so, honestly, you know, you guys at home, keep an eye on teams that wear purple. Maybe
LSU and Clemson football.
That's
the power color.
That's a fair point. So that was my number two. Not much to talk about there. It's just awesome. Every time I watch that highlight, and I've already watched it a few times since. It's just crazy. I was like watching the game with my mom. I couldn't believe it over Thanksgiving. So that was my number two.
And as a Maryland guy, there had to be something fun.
Oh, you better believe. And especially
for full disclosure here.
Oh, 100%, 100%. And to be honest, a lot of the critiques you had about motion offense earlier are things that I think strongly about Maryland. I wish they would set stronger picks, but
yeah,
that's besides the point.
That's big for me, man. I love a guy who can set a screen and a guy who can use a screen.
Like, not to harp on that, but if your offense relies on a double screen to initiate the point guard, if you set a weak screen at the first one, then you've already taken out two parts of your offense because you're not going to have like the second pick be anything good because you've allowed the first defender to come follow you. I need to move on because I'll
get worked out. We need to talk about this. There are times, you know, I think trying to educate the viewer is an important thing. I think,
and me.
You know, I love soccer, but I'm still, I mean, very much learning soccer. I'm learning basketball as well. But, you know, when my son gives me pointers and tells me, it helps me enjoy the game. But like the two, like a staggered screen, double screen, sometimes the first guy will kind of miss the screen on purpose if he's trying to free up to do something else. You know, you don't want to get tangled up. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times when you watch, you got to think, okay, I'm looking at the action. Say three guys are involved. Say it's a double staggered ball screen. What is the priority? Now, if it's to get the point guard a shot or the guy with the ball, then boom, you want two great screens, right? If you're trying to slip the first guy, maybe he's going to get a flare screen and go to the corner. You're going to try to skip it to him. Just a random possibility here. Then he's going to set a looser screen. So that's one thing to think about when we judge offenses and what they're doing. Make sure as fans, we're trying to get a grasp of what's the ultimate objective of this action. Now, the problem is I think a lot of teams, they don't have it. I think they're just running let's just draw a play here. And they execute it like that. I think the great coaches, X and O's are important. But X and O's, they don't really win the game. The players do, and then the synergy between the players and the X and O. So having the proper X and O's for your personnel, but then really making sure your team understands, this is what we really want, this is what we'll take, and, you know, if nothing else, it's our third option.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone buys into that. And that's what you see from great teams and teams that make a run at the end of a season.
Honest to God, I feel smarter every time you open your mouth. So this is cool. So that was my number two. We had Stephen F. Austin over Duke inside Cameron Indoor Stadium. My number one was the only off-court story. And you mentioned maybe the FBI. This wasn't exactly the FBI investigation, but it was tangentially related. My number one story was the NCAA gives Kansas a notice of allegations in late September. Within a week, Kansas has its late night at the fog announcement, you know, like where
this is be my number one, maybe. This is crazy.
This is my number one, right?
Okay, is your number one too. Okay,
Bill
I
Self
like
wearing
it.
The giant.
I'd forgotten already.
I had two, and then I remember this. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is obviously my number one. I think this really was the inspiration for that episode. And he wears the Adidas shirt, he wears the chains, and announces that Snoop Dogg is performing at Late Night at the Fog. And then Snoop Dogg goes and shoots money cannons at pole dancers during the event. And
sounds fun.
I know. It sounds like exactly what you would get.
Crazy. Oh,
wow. And then Kansas was like, whoa, we didn't know what Snoop Dogg. I was like, boy, Snoop Dogg has been a cultural icon for over two decades. You knew what you were getting when you invited Snoop Dogg and you wanted that. It was the biggest slap in the face I could ever imagine to the NCAA. And I was here for all of the smoke.
What was the excuse? They said Snoop said they had, or his people said they had acrobats. Was that the term used for the dancers?
I don't know.
I think it was like an acrobat act.
Whatever it was.
But that was crazy. And as you pointed out, given the circumstances that Kansas was in, made it even crazier.
Yeah, I mean, it was just awesome. And every single word that Kansas said after the fact was a bunch of malarkey.
Yeah, they're smart people. That was pretty much my take.
they're smart people.
Well,
they know what they're doing.
Self was pimping out there in the camp. I mean, like the day of, like before it happened. Yeah. You know, he had the chain and the Adidas shirt.
Which is legendary.
So they were playing it up. Mm-hmm. And then Snoop gave him a little more, maybe. I could see it was a little more than they expected, but you got to expect the unexpected with Snoop, right?
Yeah. And of course, the irony is that of the players that have been mentioned in conjunction with Kansas and this investigation, Silvio D'Souza is the only one that actually made it to Kansas, and he's just not been a factor for them. He's playing, but
He hasn't looked very good, has he?
No, and of course the other team that was involved in D'Souza's recruitment was Maryland,
yep.
And can't imagine they'd be any better with him either. So that was my top five craziest stories of 2019. Very curious to see what I think we're going to have to do that episode again next year. But very curious to see what will happen this year. But I'm glad to hear that you agree with most of my assessments.
Yeah, it's a solid list.
Thank you. So we're going to take a quick break. That took longer than I expected, and I'm not unhappy about that. On the other side, we're going to talk about three-guard offenses, switching on defense, and the evolution of the modern game.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, and we're back with Jerry Meyer, college basketball's assist king. And Jerry, already in the front half of this episode, has been educating me, and hopefully you guys at home too, about some things about modern basketball. But in the back half, we really wanted to start off the year with some smart conversations about the way basketball is played. Because, you know, there really isn't so much going on game-wise in terms of college basketball. So this is an opportunity for us to really hone in on what we want to watch for as conference play really begins in earnest. So, Jerry, you emailed me yesterday and you said, let's talk about switching on defense. Let's talk about three-guard lineups. And let's talk about how those two play into modern basketball. And the truth is we already got into a bit of that on the first half. But the first example we have to talk about is all the way from the beginning of this decade when we had Kentucky with John Wall, Eric Bledsoe, and that was a very unique and athletic team. And so they did a lot of this stuff early on.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a watershed moment or situation, but you know, it's Kentucky, so everyone's very aware of what's going on with Kentucky. And they had John Wall, and then they added Eric Bledsoe to the recruiting class. So immediately, and Eric wasn't a really well-known name, but the people in the know had him. Well, he played for a Monpaw AAU team. He wasn't on Slam, cover Slam magazine. You know, he wasn't John Wall. He wasn't not a McDonald's All-American. The people in the know did have him as a five-star. So the people in the know are like, how's this going to work? You know, Eric wants the ball. Eric's a point guard. Of course, John Wall, same deal. But Kentucky made it work. And, you know, Eric Bledsoe did a lot to make it work because he did take sort of the second spot. He had his time to handle the ball. But you saw that work at Kentucky, and then Cal saw it working, Coach Cal. So you started hearing this talk of, you know, positionless basketball. And it's not like Coach Calipari invented that, but he did kind of coin that phrase and get it into popular use, positionless basketball. And you saw it work, and I think you saw where Cal saw he had an opportunity to use it for recruiting. Because your best guards are typically point guard types, right? To be honest, and this used to be a dirty word, I'm just going to go on a little tangent here. The dirty word was combo guard in the scouting business. Because a lot of people said combo guard, that means he's not really a point. He's not really a shooting guard. Personally, I would call that a tweener. If you're not quite this, you're not quite that. To me, combo guard is what you want. And if you look at the NBA, like Markel Fultz, he's starting at point guard. He was always considered a shooting guard in high school. Oh, he's not a true point guard. He's not a true, you know, I hate hearing that true point guard and pure this and pure that. There's no purity. You know, we're talking pragmatism. That's win the game, get the numbers. So you look at the NBA, almost all the point guards are combo guards. They're guys that everyone said, oh, he's not really a point guard. And I get that when I'm doing these high school guys. I'm like, no, he's a point. Why? Because he shoots too good? Yeah. You know, because he can score?
Or he's
like,
too tall?
Do we want a point guard, you know, do we want our point guards to be Greg Paulus? You know, just dribble, get the ball across half court and make an entry pass. And then, you know, maybe run over there and set a screen or what. No, we want a point guard that can make it happen.
Someone
you know, we want a guy who can do everything, who creates the offense. And you can't do that very well if you can't shoot. So I digress on that. But
this is at all levels, right? People talk about pure point guards in the NBA, but you know who's bringing up the ball, initiating offense? Giannis, guy's 7 feet tall. You got LeBron, Doncic. You know who had
player.
Exactly, right? You know
that's
who had
why
a
I like
really
the 24 second clock, because I don't need to see Johnny out there dribbling for 10 seconds. You know, get the ball in the hands of the best playmaker. And let's get it going.
You know who had a really good week just past couple weeks? Michael Porter Jr. out in Denver.
Didn't
get to see so much in college. But again, someone who doesn't look like a point guard but knows how to initiate the offense,
it's
can handle
playmaker.
The ball in the pick and roll, can shoot, can attack. And why are, you know, the question is, and I think you're answering, why are we waiting for somebody else to initiate the offense for them?
Yeah, and I liked a phrase, you know, a phrase you said just caught me. He doesn't look like a point guard. And that's kind of, you know, I guess my kind of beef right now, or the axe I'm grinding, is forget what stuff looks like. You know, this is 2020, show, 2020. Don't forget about the basketball you played. Look at the game now. And there are no rules that the point guard has to be the shortest guy on the court. You know, we figured that out. I guess Magic Johnson helped us with that. And it's a brand new game, man. And these guys are all skilled. So you got your guy who's 6'8", who played, you know, small forward or power forward in college perhaps, and, you know, coming up, he dribbles as well as the 6'2 point guard in many cases, and he can do so much more because of his other physical attributes.
Mm-hmm. And you also see, and now we're completely going off the rails, but it's good. You also see stronger point guards all of a sudden going down into the block, which I like.
Yes, inverting the offense.
Exactly. Like, who's to say that just because the size mismatch isn't 6'11 over 6'7, you can't go into the point? I love when Marcus Smart does that. I think he is one of the smartest and strongest players in the NBA.
There's no guard who wants to guard that.
Yeah, right? And he wasn't doing that at Oklahoma State. At Oklahoma State, he was driving the ball and going to yam on people.
And you're making defenders ideally defend positions of the court they're not comfortable with. So a lot of guards are not comfortable guarding in the post, right? A lot of bigs are not comfortable guarding out in the perimeter. So that's part of modern contemporary basketball, is trying to invert the offense, get guys in spots that are uncomfortable, which leads to why teams want to switch and they want players who can switch. And I must say one other thing. When I think of point guards or guards posting up, Gary Payton and Mark Jackson.
Yes,
I think those are the two guys who, you know, were groundbreakers.
Early in adapters.
That, yeah. Right. They were on the forefront of that. I think Jason Kidd maybe posted a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, all guards have at times. John Stockton setting the screen up for the big guy. I mean, I always loved that play that the Jazz ran where Stockton would hit the wing, make that UCLA cut down to the block, and then he would go cross screen for Malone. Tough as nails, took a lot of tough shots. But when you have a point guard who can screen, so I'll go from here, it's very valuable. Right, because is John Stockton's guy going to switch off? And that doesn't sound very good because he's guarding Karl Malone. And if Stockton's tough enough to pick that guy off, you're in trouble. But the ability, versatility as a skill. Let's look at it that way. I think Jay Billis and other people have said playing hard is a skill. So it's kind of on that tip. Let's expand our view of what a skill is in basketball. And, you know, technically versatility may not be a skill, but highly, highly valued. So like in my scouting, when you see a player who can, you know, guard most any position, he has a skill set that's well-rounded. You also love players who have a niche or a niche. But that versatility where a coach can say, man, we can switch with this guy on multiple positions. We can play him in multiple spots on the court offensively. He can contribute in multiple ways offensively. He rebounds both ends for us. You know, guys like that are so valuable for today's game, the way it's being played.
Mm-hmm. And so I want to bring this full circle back to the college game because we've mentioned a couple times the NBA already. And without question, the NBA is significantly more efficient than the college game.
And so that is a great way to put it, and so true.
And so the question is, when a college team is, and I want to bring this back to Kentucky, when a college team is running one of these three guard sets, let's say, what are the drawbacks? What are the things that, like, you might say, a college team that's running this, I'm worried about X, Y, and Z that I know in the NBA they'll take care of because they're on top of it.
I mean, nothing really. That's type of ball I like.
Well, where could they
help me out on this? I want those three guards to be my concern, and then help refine my answer. But my immediate thought to me, it's just how good are the players, you know? So if you got three really good guards that, you know, have basically, you know, not perfectly complete games, you know, they can dribble, pass, shoot. You know, to me, it's just how good are they. Structurally, I have no problem with it. As long as they can defend and rebound. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to hold your own on the other end. But, man, to me, the game is about spacing, movement, and explosiveness. And the type of power ball where you're going for length over quickness, you know, type. If you're valuing that as a coach and you're trying to pound the ball inside, that's not my type of ball, man. I just don't think it's the best way to play the game, and I for sure don't like to watch it.
Okay, so let's talk about a team that you mentioned in the first half, last year's Virginia team, when you had, let's choose the three players that you mentioned. You had Ty Jerome, you had Kyle Guy, and you had DeAndre Hunter, three guys who could be the ball handler in a pick and roll and also be, you know, off guys on the wing. So what were the things that you saw them do on offense that really says to you, see, this is why I like the three guard or three ball handler set?
Well, you know, Virginia with that crew, a little different than a lot of three guard setups in that it's not a lot of three guard setups, it's primarily about dribble penetration. And Virginia's doing a lot of screening off the ball and trying to free guys off the ball. What I liked about that Virginia team, DeAndre Hunter, he just had a jack of all trades, and he could play with size. He could score inside. He could get to the rim, draw fouls. You know, he was a great small forward. And it did all the things you'd want from a small forward. Loved Guy's ability to move without the basketball. Ty Jerome just had just such great court awareness and a sense of where people are going to be. You know, they're three NBA players. and they were playing in the Tony Bennett system, and they embraced it. They did it well. They played well together. I find it interesting, if I may, real quick. Like, I watched DeAndre Hunter play the other night, and basically he was initiating their offense. Like, he was the guy. Like, maybe he say he didn't dribble it up, but kind of like how Dirk, and I'm not comparing the two, but I'm trying to, let's think outside the box. What do I mean by initiate the offense? When you really are doing your action to score, who has the ball? You know, Kobe maybe wasn't always the point guard, but Kobe initiated the offense, you know, the high majority of the time. And that's what DeAndre Hunter is doing. And I'm thinking, you know, people in college, he was like a 3-4. And, you know, they had Cam Reddish just tucked away in the corner. And it was DeAndre Hunter running all the action. But that's an example of, you know, evolution of the game. Call the positions what you want, but in that situation, and it was many times during the game, DeAndre Hunter was the playmaker.
So what I'm hearing from you is not necessarily a push to say, you know, I think three-guard lineups are the way to go. I hear you saying, put your best players on the floor, and they'll figure it out because they're smart.
Call them whatever you want. You need three dudes who can make plays, I think, ideally. And then guys who can finish off plays. But to have three instigators, three creators, that's what I love. You know, if you got two, that's good. If you just have one, well, at least you got one. And then, you know, those poor teams that don't have anyone who can really create a play, and they're counting on the coach, you know, drawing up their buckets. I learned that from my coaching. It's tough to coach 2 points or 3 points. I mean, you have systems and everything, but you got to have guys that can make the shot. You have to have guys who can create the situations, deliver the pass, create the double team to get a team into rotation.
So let's switch to the other side of the ball then and talk about switching.
Sure.
Because I think the old school way of thinking about switching is you have to watch out. You have to watch out because
There used to be a fear of switching
because you know the fear is inevitably we're going to end up with a 7-footer in the post against you know a guy who's my size who's 5'9" somehow. And we didn't have a guy who was 5'9" on the court before we started switching, but all of a sudden we're worried about someone you know in the post against Hakeem Olajuwon. Hakeem Olajuwon's retired, but we're still worried about that.
And I want to address that. Keep going, but don't forget that point.
No, let's start right there.
Well, all right. In my coaching career, you know, which I haven't coached in a while, I've been doing this business, but you know, I grappled with the switching thing. And what I found from being on the offensive side, you know, my team's on offense and we're being switched on, and obviously being on the defensive side, if the big fear is the mismatch, here's what I often found to be the case. Most offensive teams, when they see that mismatch, it takes them out of what they're used to doing, out of their offense. Now we're going to exploit the mismatch. So say you're getting post up. I've seen so many teams, we got to get it to the guy Tiny's guarding. We got to get it to him. And a lot of players force passes, make bad passes. It takes them out of the normal situation, you know, that they're used to playing within with their offense. And I think most coaches right now are finding that's a risk worth taking. And then if you can find personnel where you don't have a 5'8 guy getting switched off, you know, you got a bunch of 5'6" guys who are athletic, why wouldn't you switch?
You know, and let's just take an example from today's top 10. So if you're playing Kansas, I think the best player on their offense is Devon Dotson. He is the one who can create a shot most easily for any of his teammates.
Yeah.
And you want, let's say, Udoka Azubuike going one-on-one in the post rather than trusting Dotson. Because you know what? Doke gets a lot of his points based on other people's actions.
And that's how basketball is now. Because it is very difficult to score one-on-one in the post.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be in the olden days, right, everyone was trying to deny the post. And, you know, this is the style of ball I was brought up playing. So the post player's trying to seal, get an angle. You're feeding them the ball, or it leads to an easy shot.
Drop step.
You don't see drop steps anymore. I mean, every once in a while, because the defense does not give angles. They play right behind the post. Typically, if it's two big guys, and they push them out.
Very conservative.
And it's hard to score one-on-one in the post. Very hard. I remember you talk about creating offense. Most big guys do feed off their playmakers. That's why having three guys who can make plays, I mean, if you're a big guy on that team, you're like, yes. And even if I'm not getting traditional post feeds, you know, it's a lot of the big guys don't want that. It's so hard to score in those situations, so they'd rather get the dump off pass for a dunk or be freed up to get a rebound. A little anecdote from the business. You know, I worked with Shannon, and I've been in this like 16 years, and Shannon Terry, our CEO, played college basketball with him, and he knows the game. Worked with him at Rivals, and then when I came over here to 24/7, after Shannon started 24/7, he told me, he's like, Jerry, I can evaluate a point guard better than you. And I'm a little offended because I was a point guard.
That's some heat.
And I'm not saying he's right, because he wasn't. He really loved Casey Hill. So I'm not going to – but it made me think. And then he made an argument why. He said, because I was a big guy who really wasn't that great, and I needed you. You know, I needed a point guard to create my offense. So, you know, basically his point was, I think I have a better appreciation for what makes a point guard great because I was dependent on a point guard. So it's a very interesting line of thinking.
Sounds like you need to invite him to the show so that he can defend his recruiting takes.
Yeah, well, he was great. He got on the show when we first started in the spring talking NBA draft. We had a good time. Yeah, we'll get him back on later, like in a month or so.
Sounds good.
Because Shannon does know the game, and he's got a point. I see the game through a point guard's lens, and he sees it, you know, through a four-man, inside outside guy.
Literally, I can only view like a basketball court comfortably from the elbow. Like that's just like my whole life.
Like physically seeing the court.
When I'm imagining something, I'm imagining it from the perspective of a two guard. You know, like
okay, I got you.
Like because that's what like I grew
that's
up.
That's what you played.
I played two.
And again, it's
I
what shot. We're talking about here for the fans. Get outside your box, you know, and it's challenging. And you know, I think you know we can make a point. A life point. This is good for life to be able to take your mind and see things from a different perspective. And you know, that's what I try to do with sports. All the sports, you know, try to use to me, it's the joy in sports. One of the great, I mean, I love competition and I love drama, but especially I like the competition. And then the icing on the cake often is the drama at the end. But to try to expand my mind and see it through different positions, see it through the coach, try to really get a feel for what's going on. That's what I love about sports. It's mind expanding.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm trying to be mindful of the time and get everybody out here under 45 minutes. But I do want to get one last thing on the switching conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is, you know, when you see switching, are you a fan of switching 1 through 5? Are you a fan of switching 1 through 3? A fan of switching as much as you can? How do you envision that?
I would say what works for your personnel. So sure, if you have a team where you can switch 1 through 5, that's great. You see a lot of teams, they'll just switch big on big stuff, and they'll switch with the perimeters. Some teams, you know, are not going to switch on off the ball screens, but they're going to switch every ball screen or every handoff. There's different ways to do it. I just value switching because ultimately everything a coach does, it's about your personnel, you know, and obviously you can recruit a certain, so, you know, you recruit a certain type of personnel to play in a system that you prefer. You go.
Oh no! I was just gonna ask. I've never made that distinction.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily know which I prefer. I prefer what works best for that team.
Well,
so like if you're Kansas with Adoka, you're not gonna switch 1 through 5 with him because he struggles. And I've tweeted this and I've been thinking about it here recently. The ability of a big man to play defense on the perimeter is enormous. You know, if I had a guy who
it's system changing.
Right, and it gives you so much value. And if you have a guy with NBA type potential, and you're bringing him up as a big guy, oh my goodness, you watch an NBA game. If you can't guard on the perimeter, you can't play. You know, basically is a deal. Or you better if you're poor at it, you better make up for it in a lot of other ways on the court, because they are going to expose you. And everyone can shoot. Everyone can dribble now. Pretty much everyone could pass. So then that means on defense, you need to have the ability to guard all of that everywhere on the court.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I never made the distinction, though, between switching on and off ball screens.
Yeah.
Just so I can understand. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about not switching versus switching on off ball screens, that's when someone who doesn't have the ball sets a screen for another person right. who doesn't have the ball, mm-hmm. hopefully to free them up for maybe a driving action or right. a corner three or something sure. like that. You know, what are the pros and cons from a defensive perspective about switching off-ball screens versus not switching off-ball screens? Because that's something I really sure. haven't thought about.
Well, here's the danger in switching a situation like that. So, you know, say you got a perimeter player down like on the block and the big man's setting a pin down screen for him, just to give a visual example of one type. You have to be careful because if you are switching, it's called slipping the screen. So if I know a team's switching on us, it's kind of fruitless to execute that screen right into the switch, unless the purpose is to get a mismatch and he's going to get it and try to dump it down and feed the post. So what you do, and you can do this anywhere on the court, when you have two guys coming together, don't have the ball, I act like I'm screening you. And before I ever set the screen on your defender, boom, I make it, you know, I slip the screen. Yeah. I think a lot of people are familiar with that term.
Sure.
That's one way to attack, a switching defense off the ball. So that's a danger there. Most teams, I don't think there's a whole lot of teams that are switching off the ball stuff, unless...
I feel like the only time you do it's a back screen.
Unless it's the same position. Right. And even when I played on teams that didn't switch, that would be the exception.
The back screen,
if you really get back screen, boom, you got to switch. Now, if you're prepared for it and the guy helps off some, you get over the screen, you know, you don't necessarily have to, but sure. But I think most teams, just in general, my perception of what I've been seeing this season, pretty much everything on the ball, it's a switch. Off the ball, most teams are going to trail, you know, they chase the cutter, and the guy defending the screener, you know, will hedge, you know, give a little support to help the guy get through it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm excited. This is exactly the kind of stuff we want to get into on the show as the year and the season develops. We're going to hopefully be engendering smarter basketball fans, and that's kind of the whole point of this show, is to teach me and hopefully teach you guys at home. And when I say teach, I mean Jerry's doing the teaching, not me. Because, you know, I'm just a guy. I watch a lot of college basketball. I feel good about it. I think I know college basketball. But there's a different level when you've played, you've coached, you've scouted, like Jerry has.
And my dad was a great coach. So I grew up watching film. You know, all the stories about Belichick's kid, you know, Don Meyer and Jerry Meyer. Yeah, we were doing the same thing. I was in the
office. You've got better hair than Belichick's kid.
Yeah, no hair might be better than that hair.
That is definitely a take.
Although I like it.
Oh, that's
like the mullet.
I'm not into it.
I like hearing his dad speak with a mullet on, and that's what I feel like I'm watching.
All right. Well, so the basketball season, the college basketball season, is really about to kick off now that winter break is starting to come to a close for students. Teams are going to get back into it. Conference play is going to get started, and we'll get back into, you know, the actual games. And hopefully we'll be able to continue building off of this institutional basketball knowledge to talk about the games that we're seeing. And hopefully, you know, you guys at home can take these things that Jerry is teaching me and teaching us and use that to watch the games and understand the games better. Jerry, you got anything else before next week?
I'm good, man. I enjoyed it. I love talking conceptually about the game. So
well, that's good.
Really enjoyed it.
And one thing I do think we're going to have to hit on in the near future, whether it's next week or after, I'm not sure, but this is the first year in a long time that college basketball's three-point shots made percentage has gone down. And that's probably because they moved the line back, but that's something I do want to talk about. So you guys at home,
that'll be a good topic for next one. Yeah.
Keep an eye on that. And for Jerry Meyer and 24/7 Sports, I'm Tony Leavitt, and this is the 24/7 Sports College Basketball Show. We'll see you next week. Happy New Year's.
Streaming on Paramount Plus. Gather your besties.
We are very exclusive.
And get ready.
Mom, go make snacks.
For sure, Regina. Yeah.
For the movie that hits like a bus. In a good way.
No one died.
Mean Girls. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.